Part 3. From Odyssey to Odyssey. Chapter 24. August 23rd, 2006. Navidad Bank. If there was one small benefit to Hurricane Lizzie, it was that she had swept the brown crud away from Navidad Bank. The water over the coral was blue-green again, with visibility at nearly 200 feet. Along with the clean water, the fish had returned to their habitat and took up residence again as if no tempest had cast them out. Another research vessel replaced Sea Sprite for the investigation of the sunken structure. Built and designed specifically as a dive support vessel for archaeological exploration in shallow water, Sea Yesteryear rarely worked out of sight of the shore. Her projects had included the underwater ruins of the Alexandria Library in Egypt, the Chinese fleet sunk by kamikaze winds off Japan, early Swedish and Russian trade ships in the Baltic, and a host of other historical events her team of scientists had surveyed. She featured four-point mooring capabilities in both saturation and surface gas-air diving system configurations. A moon pool in the center of her hull was fully equipped for diving operations and robotic vehicle launch and recovery, and included machinery for retrieving artifacts from the seafloor. A spacious laboratory occupied the entire bow section of the boat and incorporated the most up-to-date scientific equipment for the analysis and conservation of recovered ancient artifacts. Short by most research ship standards at 151 feet in length, she was broad and roomy with an overall breadth of 45 feet. Two big diesel engines moved her through the water at 20 knots, and she carried a crew of four and a team of 10 scientists. Those who had served aboard Sea Yesteryear were proud of the times they had rewritten maritime history. And as the Navidad Bank exploration proceeded, they were certain they were on the verge of the greatest discovery yet. At first, the marine archaeologists who examined the rooms of stone were not even certain the structures were man-made, nor did the area produce an abundance of artifacts. Except for the contents of the stone bed and the cauldron, the only others found came from the kitchen. But as the investigation continued, more and more incredible archaeological treasures were recorded. One revelation that the geologists on the team discovered was that the structure once sat in the open above a small hill. This came to light when the encrustation on one 6-inch square piece of wall in the bedroom was delicately brushed away, and it became obvious the rooms were not carved from the rock, but constructed of stone, fitted on stone when Navidad Bank was an island rising above the water. Dirk stood in the laboratory with his sister at his side, examining the artifacts that had been carefully transported to the ship's laboratory and immersed in trays of seawater in preparation for the lengthy conservation process. He very gently held up an exquisite gold torque, the neck chain that had been found on the stone bed. "Every relic we've removed from the bed and the cauldron has belonged to a woman. It's even more intricate than much of the jewelry produced today," said Summer, admiring the chain as the gold reflected from the sun through the ship's ports. "Until I can make a comparison with archaeological records in European archives, I'd have to date it as Middle Bronze Age." The voice was soft and punctuated, like a mild summer shower on a metal roof. It belonged to Dr. Jeffrey Parks, who carried himself like a wary wolf, with his face low and thrust out. He was 6 feet 8 inches in height and constantly bent over from the stratosphere. A collegiate all-star basketball player, he was sidelined because of a serious knee injury and never played again. Instead, he studied marine archaeology, eventually gaining a doctorate with his thesis on ancient underwater cities. He had been invited on the expedition by Admiral Sandecker because of his specialized expertise. Parks walked past the long table fitted with open tanks that held the ancient relics and stopped at a large board mounted on a bulkhead that displayed more than 50 photos taken of the interior of the underwater edifice. He paused and, with the eraser end of a pencil, tapped a montage of photos showing the floor plan. "What we have is not a city or a fortress. No structures that extend beyond the rooms of your original discovery are apparent. Call it a mansion for its time, or a small palace that became the tomb of an elite woman. Perhaps a queen or a high priestess who was rich enough to commission her own jewelry." "Pity there is nothing left of her," said Summer. "Not even an indication of her skull. Even her teeth are gone." Parks gave a slight twist of his mouth. "Her bones disappeared centuries ago, along with all her garments, soon after the structure was inundated by the sea." He moved to a large photograph taken before the artifacts were removed from the stone bed and tapped the pencil again on a close-up picture of the bronze body armor. She must have been a warrior who led men into battle. The cuirass in the photo looks made of one piece and had to be put on over the head like a metal sweater. Summer tried to imagine how the cuirass would fit on her. She had read that the Celts were large people for their time, but the armor looked far too small for her torso. How in the world did she come to be here?
I haven't a clue, said Parks.
As a traditional archaeologist who isn't supposed to believe in diffusion, the contact between the Americas and other parts of the world before Columbus, I'm required to say that this is an elaborate hoax perpetrated by the Spanish sometime after 1500. Summer frowned.
You can't really believe that.
Parks gave a tiny smile.
Not really.
Not after what we've seen here. But until we can prove without doubt how these artifacts came to be on Navidad Bank, the controversy will shake the world of ancient history.
Summer made her case.
But it was possible for ancient seafarers to cross the sea.
No one says it was impossible.
People have crossed the Atlantic and Pacific in everything from boats made out of cowhides to 6-foot sailboats. It's entirely conceivable that fishermen from Japan or Ireland were blown by storms to the Americas. Archaeologists admit there are many curious bits and pieces of evidence that suggest European and Asian influence throughout Central and South American art and architecture. But no legitimate object from this side of the pond has been found over there.
Our father found proof of the Vikings' presence in the United States, argued Summer.
And he and Al Giordino discovered artifacts from the Alexandria Library in Texas, added Dirk.
Park shrugged.
The fact still remains that artifacts proven to have come from the Americas have yet to turn up from excavations in Europe or Africa.
Ah, said Summer, shooting her arrow. What about the traces of nicotine and cocaine that have been found in Egyptian mummies?
Tobacco and cocoa leaves came only from the Americas.
I thought you'd bring that up, Parks said with a sigh.
Egyptologists are still fighting over that one.
Summer frowned thoughtfully.
Could the answers still be down in the rooms?
Maybe, Parks admitted.
Our marine biologists are running tests on the encrustation found on the walls, while our phytochemist examines studies about the remains of plant life in an effort to determine a timeline for how long the building was covered by the sea.
Summer looked lost in thought.
Could there be any inscriptions under the encrustation? Something the archaeologists might have missed?
Parks laughed.
The early Celts left behind no art or written records depicting their culture. Finding carved inscriptions would be implausible, unless, of course, we're wrong in our dating of Navinia.
Navinia?
Parks stared at a computer printout of the architecture of the sunken structure as it might have looked when built.
It's as good a name as any, don't you think?
As good as any, Dirk echoed. He looked at Summer.
Why don't you and I dive first thing tomorrow morning and search the walls for inscriptions?
Besides, I think it only fitting that we pay our respects to our high priestess for the last time.
Don't linger too long, said Parks. The captain has given notice that the anchors come up at noon. He wants to transport the artifacts to Fort Lauderdale as soon as possible.
As they exited the laboratory, Summer looked at Dirk with a curious gleam in her eye.
Since when are you overcome with nostalgia?
There is a practical method to my madness.
Oh, and what is that? She asked dryly.
He stared back at her with a crooked little grin.
I have an idea something important was missed.
Now that they knew where to continue the search, they swam straight to the anteroom. The ancient compartments were empty now. Only yesterday it had looked like an airport waiting room. The ship's scientists were probing every nook and cranny. Now, with all the artifacts removed and under preservation aboard sea yesteryear, and their investigation all but finished, they were back on board, compiling and evaluating their findings. Dirk and Summer had the submerged rooms all to themselves. Now that there were no archaeologists looking over their shoulders, they saw little reason to treat the walls with gloves of velvet. As planned, they began their search in the entry chamber, Summer examining one wall while Dirk took the other, scraping away any sea growth or incrustation with putty knives until they reached bare stone, knowing they were committing sacrilege in the eyes of a conscientious archaeologist.
They worked the walls, scraping in long horizontal bands, concentrating from 4 to 5 feet from the floor. Because the average height of people 3,000 years ago was several inches shorter than in the present, their eye level would have been lower. Using this historical fact, Dirk and Summer decided to compress their search area. It was slow going. After an hour of fruitless inspection, they returned to sea yesteryear to replace their nearly empty air tanks. Although all Numa dive support vessels carried hyperbaric chambers, Dirk meticulously checked the repetitive dive tables with his computer to avoid decompression sickness. 20 minutes into their second dive, after they moved from the antechamber deeper into a long hallway, Summer suddenly tapped the handle of her putty knife on the wall to attract Dirk's attention. He immediately swam to her side and stared at the section on the wall she had scraped and was excitedly pointing at. She had scraped the letters pictographs in the growth. Dirk nodded and gave a thumbs up in elation. Together they began feverishly cleaning the encrusted stones with their gloved hands and fingers, working cautiously so they did not damage the precious relic that slowly materialized in the gloom. Finally, the carved images in the stone were exposed. Brother and sister felt a sense of triumph in knowing they had outfoxed the professionals and were looking at something no other human had laid eyes on in 3,000 years. The pictographs offered a much sought-after clue to the mystery of the sunken house. Dirk turned his dive light on the stone depictions to highlight their details. Further investigation revealed that the images traveled down both sides of the hallway in two bands 2 feet wide and about 5 feet off the floor. The pattern was similar in design to the Bayeux tapestry that illustrated the Battle of Hastings in 1066. Dirk and Summer hung in the water and stared in almost religious awe at the sculpted carvings that depicted men sailing in ships. They were strange-looking men, with large round eyes and thick beards. Their weapons consisted of long daggers, short swords with an angle, and battle axes with curved edges. Several of the soldiers rode in chariots alone, but most fought on foot. Battle scenes with much carnage were rendered. The scenes seemed to portray several battles in a protracted war. There were also images of women with bared breasts throwing spears into their enemy. Summer lightly ran one gloved hand over the female figures. She turned to Dirk and smiled a superior feminine smile. The ornamental scenes began with ships leaving a burning city. Further along, the ships were tossed about by storms, followed by land battles with odd-looking creatures. Near the bottom, there was only one ship left of the fleet, the rest having been destroyed. Then it, too, was depicted sinking in a storm. Near the end, an image showed a man and woman embracing before he sailed away on what looked like a raft with a sail. They had found a classic chronicle carved in stone by an ancient artisan that had stood unseen by human eyes under the sea for thousands of years. Dirk and Summer gazed at each other through their face masks in exhilaration, never imagining that they would find anything so incredible and so extraordinary. Dirk motioned toward the doorway leading out into the reef. The dive light blinked out, and they turned and swam toward the surface, leaving the precious treasure exposed for those who would soon follow and photograph and reveal the pictographs in their full glory.